Welcome to Dentology, the Business of Dentistry podcast. In this podcast, we delve into the non-clinical aspects of dentistry with inspirational guests from across the profession. You will hear incredible life stories, pick up valuable business tips, and be entertained. I'm Andy Acton, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Drevens.
So, Dr. Richard Marks, what an interesting, eclectic practice he runs.
Yeah, it's lovely, isn't it? It's a great variety. I love his experience, and I love that he was so calculated, might not be the right word, in what he wanted to do. So as he got that broad range of experience before he starts treating people like Rita Ora.
And I think that has set him up so incredibly well for the practice he's now got in terms of, you know, his chairside manner, his communication skills, but also just breaking down how he ended up becoming the dentist of the stars, you know, and really unpicking it and the groundwork that he put in before he kind of made it. It's that thing, isn't it? You know, it took me 20 years to become an overnight success.
There's no such thing as an overnight success. I think it will be a really good educational lesson. And it was fun as well.
It was. Yeah, lovely guy. They keep coming, don't they?
They do, as every week.
Exactly. Lovely. And we've got a wonderful star joining us today. So today we have a dentist, also the owner and principal dentist at Dr. Richard Clinics London, a podcast host in his own right, hosting the Dr. Richard podcast, and dentist to the stars.
Oh, look at dentist to the stars.
So it's welcome to Dr. Richard Marks. How are you, Richard?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, brilliant. Not to be confused with the songwriter.
Yes, Richard Marks, and he was quite a good songwriter as well.
Yeah, he's very good.
Hazard comes on the radio with. Still. Does that ever happen? Do people confuse you with the song star of the 80s?
I wouldn't mind if they did.
Can you imagine? We booking restaurants would be quite cool, wouldn't it? I was saying one of my friends, his name is David Foster, and there was he used to work for a private bank in California. And obviously David Foster is a world famous songwriter. So he used to get his secretary to book a table for David Foster, and he'd turn up and the people would be like, "Well, you're not David Foster." And he'd say, "No, I am." But can you imagine? That'd be brilliant. Yeah, a table for Richard Marks? Certainly, sir.
Well, I imagine if you turn up with some of your patients, you probably get a fantastic table anyway, but we'll come on to that later. Richard, you host your own podcast, and you very kindly invited me on to it a little while ago. And one of the questions that you asked me and you ask all of your guests is, what makes you smile? So to turn the tables and to kick off, what makes you smile?
I think there's many things that made me smile, but for me, it is those things, family, friends, my partner, and my job as well. So those things make me smile. And I think I'm lucky in my job to be giving a smile to someone else, you know. So with cosmetic dentistry, you know, we're helping people smile. Sometimes people have been really unconfident about smiling, and then we're able to help them to smile. And also we hope that they find it a pleasant experience if possible. So we hope they're smiling anyway.
I think it's interesting. I think lots of dentists, it's easy to get wrapped up in the very clinical side of things is what's being achieved, and don't get me wrong, that's incredibly important, but I think sometimes it's easy to lose sight of the impact you can have on someone's confidence and how they feel about themselves and how they interact with other people, and that comes from a smile, you know. If someone smiles at you, it's very hard not to smile back, isn't it? But that has to come from a place of confidence, and you can give that to people, which I think is a remarkable skill.
Definitely.
Yeah, it's really a gift to be able to do that, and you know, it's a real privilege. And I think, you know, people are coming in and sometimes they're nervous, sometimes they have phobias, and you just want to be as gentle and understanding as you can, you know, and those things are really important. And I think this is a new way of dentistry, is like, you know, not that very much, hopefully not scary, and making it just a better experience and kind of reframing it for people from those kind of, like, people have the school dentists and stuff. People just feel scared about these things. But it's like taking that experience and being like, look, actually dentists can be friendly, we've got your best interest at heart, and you know, we're in healthcare, that's the important thing. Like,
do you think that's never been easier with social media? Because it's much easier to demonstrate your personality, your soft side, what it is you do. Whereas historically, there was always a negative connotation of, you know, blood and pain and dental practice all smelled a particular way. But it was no other channel for a dentist to kind of show another side to themselves. I think with social media and other digital tools, it's never probably been easier to show people the other side of dentists and that they are real people and they do care.
Yeah, I think social media has really helped. Firstly, with cosmetic dentistry, it's a very visual thing. Mm. So we can show like before and afters. But also now we can show a bit of our personality and, you know, as you said, kind of take away this kind of apprehension that people have. And it's nice to be able to get that across, that we are actually humans, you know.
Much to contrary belief, they're not robots. They're really nice people,
and they have feelings.
Exactly. And as a family, you've got lineage that goes back to your Portuguese grandfather. He was the first, I think, of the dentists in your family. So with that kind of, you know, your grandfather and your parents, was for you, was dentistry never in doubt? Were there never any other choices?
Well, it's really interesting because, as you say, my grandfather was the first. He came from Portugal. He actually studied in Durham University, where he met my grandmother. And obviously, my father's a dentist. My mother was in dental school. My uncle, there's a lot of us. Oh, wow. My sister, she's a dental therapist. So, there's quite a few of us in dentistry. But the thing is, which I would say, is that there was a time I was always kind of looked up to my dad. He's an amazing person, you know, a brilliant dentist, and he was like a great figurehead for the family. He worked really hard and he was very passionate about his job, and he, you know, he's retired now, but he still has passion for what he did. But I think that there was a time where I was thinking, oh, maybe I'm going to be anything but a dentist, you know, and I was thinking, oh, what other options are there out there for me? I did think about medicine, about law, and I thought about many other different avenues to go down, something more creative like advertising, marketing, those kind of things. So there were lots of different things that I thought about, and writing as well. But in the end, I just saw that, I think it's because my dad did really enjoy his job, you know, that, and he had a real passion for it, and that kind of made me think, actually, you know, it's a great thing to do. And I actually find that it is a very human job, and you are it's whatever it's easier that it can sound, you are helping people and you are making a difference. So I think that those things really, really help to make it a great profession. And it's like, sometimes people can go through their career and they wonder, in different careers, they wonder, what am I doing in this office job? What have I done? But every day, you know, as a dentist, you know, you've made a difference to somebody. So, you know, at the end of every day, you can feel like I've had a hopefully positive effect on people, and you've done something very human. You've fixed a tooth, got someone out of pain, you know, helped them with their smile, you know, this. And so, all of those things make this job really, really a great job if healthcare is something that you're passionate about.
Yeah, everyone wants to do something rewarding, don't they? Where you actually, and what's great is with dentistry, as you say, you actually get to see the output and the effect you have.
It's very tangible. Yeah, you get a real result.
It's not like someone disappears and then they might have a good, you know, what you've said, but actually, it's physically so there, you can see it, what you've done.
Yeah, and it's quite intimate, and it's also ongoing as well, isn't it? You know, it's not one of those jobs where you do something for somebody and then they move on and that's it. You have an ongoing relationship, which is nice. And clearly, your father was passionate about it. And that kind of, whether that got fed to him from you know, your grandfather, but that kind of passion fed through to you. And I think you're right. I think if you do something you enjoy, you're much more likely to stick with it. I mean, one of our previous guests is, we spoke to Christian Coachman, and he's a sixth generation dentist. So his family has, I don't think he stood a chance.
Even more than me.
Exactly. Yeah, you never know. The Marxes are there. You know, you've got three on the books now. There might be more to come.
You got any children? What are they doing?
So, yeah. But yeah, like I said, I think if you speak to somebody who is passionate, there's no doubt that it does fire you up to do that. So then you then went to King's and St. Thomas's. What was dental school like for you? Was it an enjoyable experience? Did you have to apply yourself or did you breeze through it?
Or did you party?
You know what was interesting? There's some interesting things about that. It was a fantastic time. Like, it's literally one of the best times of your life. It's university, and I can say it was an amazing time. The thing is, I thought at that time, and I think a lot of dentists can relate to this, that when you're a dental student, you think, oh, this is so difficult. I'm going through all these examinations. This is a really difficult part in my life. Where in reality, this is the easiest part of your life.
You just don't know it then.
You don't know it. And the other thing is that you also want to have that freedom. That's the difficult part, is you want to have that freedom, that fun. But at the same time, you've got something really serious to do. And for a dentist, even from the second year, you're treating patients. Mm. So responsibility comes very early. You know, we enter dental school at 18, so by 19 we're seeing patients. So, you know, it's quite a lot of responsibility. But I think if it's something you embrace, you will enjoy that. The dental school, they were this King's and guys and St. Thomas's. It's known to be quite, strict or quite a hard. It was quite a difficult course. But at the same time, that teaches you a lot because they hold you to a very high standard, you know. But it was funny, like, I had always done really well in examinations through my whole life. I've always been quite good in exams, but I remember there was like a mini test early on and I didn't pass it. And I thought there must be some kind of mistake with the grading. But I had to realize that this is not going to be a walk in the park. Yeah. It's going to really test you. But by testing you, it makes you become better, you know. And I have a lot to thank for them for really, putting us through that hard dental education, which made us the best dentists possible.
Sometimes it's good to have that early kickback, isn't it? You're sort of like, oh, maybe I'm not Midas, everything I touch doesn't turn to gold and I have got to refocus it. I think that's a great
I don't really like that idea, but yeah.
Yeah, you like the principle of it, not just the feeling.
Yeah.
I know. Well, it was also interesting, like, back in that time, like, dental school's changed a lot now, because as we were coming into dental school, to make us look more professional, we had to wear a shirt and a tie and a floor-length white coat. Which I don't think they do now because, you know, times have moved on and things have really developed. But that was because also we were only young 18, 19-year-olds to give the patients some form of confidence.
Gave them more gravitas, so you're like proper scientists. Yeah,
absolutely. So that was a funny experience as well.
Yeah. So you qualify, and then we'll get to your practice and how you styled that in a minute. But once you'd qualified, what did you move around a fair bit? Did you stick in London and get the experience of a number of different practices?
So obviously, you know, I started out on the NHS and I did some locuming as well, which I think is really good. And I worked in different practices, like dotted around the country. My father, he moved to Dorset, so I worked a little bit around there. And I also worked in some practices that were not in London, just to get some experience from working in really different kinds of practices. So
was that a conscious decision on your part back then, Richard? Did you purposely seek out to work in different places to build on that experience?
For me, I wanted to have different experiences. Like, if I had just started in London and had a very linear career, I feel like that would not give the well-roundedness that I wanted to have.
Smart, very smart. Yeah.
So I really enjoyed working in NHS practices and mixed practices, people from different backgrounds. And I think that really teaches you something. And it's also, there's a really humbling experiences when we used to do something which was for the PCT, which was an emergency contract where people would come and they would be possibly like, they would have gone for hospital dentistry, but they came to the practice and they weren't registered with a dentist. They were in pain. And, you know, these were people who were covered by the system rather than self-paying patients most of the time. And so it really, you see something else of people that are really, you know, in very great dental need, and that teaches you something.
And, yeah, you know, I think it's a very different side of society, and I hope that the NHS will always be there for those people. I know it's being reformed, it's being changed, but I'd like to continue living in a country where people that you know, for different reasons, aren't able to access private dentistry, still have access to that level of care.
Yeah, and I would always try, you know, what I was doing within my limited ability to do my best that I can in that remit, you know, and provide the best care, and, you know, obviously treating everybody, you know, as well as you can. And, you know, I think that's really important, and it teaches you a lot about humanity and people. And I think in a way it's important not to be straight into private and kind of maybe isolate yourself from seeing other things. So I kind of recommend to people to get different experiences, and
that's interesting,
and that's important.
Yeah, we were having a conversation with Samir Patel, the principal of 11 Dental. We were talking to him, and he shared the same view. He said that experience you get working on the NHS early on in your career is incredibly valuable, because it exposes you to very different sections of society. Yeah, the dentistry that comes at you is quite broad in its reach of what's required. And I think his view and the view that you just shared, which is if you perhaps, you know, head into the private sector too soon, you don't get that exposure, and not just a clinical exposure, in terms of the exposure to society and a broader breadth
and communication
of people.
Dealing with multitudes and different people with different needs, I think, is that.
I think it's very smart of you to have approached it in that way early on. I think lots of people would have just had their head down and thought, I don't think they'd have thought beyond the mouth, because you're dentists, whereas you were kind of thinking more about the people and the patients and the experience of which the mouth was part of.
Yeah, I think that's extremely important, is remember there's a person attached to the teeth and the mouth.
It's not all phantom heads.
What was that? There was some professor or something we did a lecture with or something one time, and he said, some people perceive the patient as a biological method to get the mouth into your chair. And it was like, whoa. Wow. Okay, you've forgotten the people.
I know. There was a hilarious, I mean, this is actually quite worrying in a way, but there was a book, and this is a real book of historic pediatric dentistry, and there were techniques for treating children, and there was techniques of, and this is not a joke, there was a technique called the hand over mouth technique, where you tell the child, I'm not taking my hand off until you be quiet. And this was in a textbook.
Wow.
Improved learning.
Yeah, flip.
And then there was this board which they would put on them, which held their arms and legs so they couldn't. This is absolute truth. You know, and they showed us this as a kind of historical artifact of how things have changed so much, you know. Yeah. And now everything in terms of techniques is showing somebody something, and you start with a much smaller treatment first, and you can break it down, you know, them just getting in the chair to start with, and then becoming a client advisor, you might do a dental cleaning first and work their way up to the bigger treatment. So things have changed so much.
Yeah. And talking about working up to bigger things, you're now the principal of Dr. Richard's clinics in London. And you're now incredibly well known for treating high profile patients, you know, actors, sports stars, musicians, among others. And if you just take a quick scroll through Richard's Instagram feed, it's like a who's who of celebrities. How did you become the go-to dentist for celebrities? How did that come about? Because people will see where you are now and you know, Retraw, among others, you know, A-list celebrities are visiting you on a regular basis. But what was the start point? Did you plan for this to be part of your business, or has it just evolved?
I think, you know, that these things don't happen overnight, and nobody sees necessarily the journey to getting to that place. But there was a time where, because I was interested in cosmetic and aesthetic dentistry, I did think, how can I get my work out there? And I think by having your cosmetic dentistry on someone well-known, then people can see that smile and they can identify with it and think, oh, I might like a smile like somebody. And I first started to become kind of in the press, to become a dentist that kind of spoke in the press about dentistry when I was asked, and kind of putting it into terms that real people could understand, you know, rather than in a very kind of academic and journal referencing way, something, the really important advice of, you know, cutting down your sugar, flossing, brushing, you know, all those important things that people need to know. And then after that, I got to know quite a few journalists, and I also got to know agents, and then they kind of put me in touch with different celebrities at first. One of the first people smile I did is Joey Essex.
I was going to say, your first one almost?
That was one of my first big smiles, and that became quite famous, you know. So there is a lot of luck involved as well. And, you know, I went on TV on This Morning, and these things just happen. But also,
you say luck, Richard. I have a notion. I think luck is the combination of being prepared and opportunity. I think you were prepared, and when the opportunity presented itself, you took it.
And
I think
that's spotting the opportunity.
Yeah, and that looks like luck, but you did a lot of groundwork in courting the media to share dental messages in a mainstream way, which then expose you to that world. So I think you're playing yourself down. I think you were ready for it when it came along.
Yeah, and when I was, you know, always been incredibly like into hard working, and I've always been someone who believed in that, and that was something taught to me by my family. And when I first started, I was doing late nights, early mornings, you know, weekends. I still do, but even more so at that time, you know, I was working over Easter and Christmas. So I think hard work is important as well. Being dedicated is important. But yeah, also the celebrity world is quite small. So when people know each other, and then that word of mouth and recommendation, you know, and that spreads. So, you know, once it gets going, it's like the snowball effect.
That must be part of the exciting bit of, so how did you find me? Well, I was referred by so-and-so. Oh, okay.
Yeah. And does that world bring its own unique demands as well? Because I imagine that you've probably got enhanced privacy issues. You've got potentially show deadlines. You've got time demands of when they're actually going to be in the country and, you know, their schedule. So are they more challenging to treat than other patients? Not because they're a problem in their own right, but just because of their schedule and their notoriety.
Yeah, absolutely. With their scheduling, it is can be really challenging. And say, oh, we need this done at the last minute, and also, can we do this on the weekend or late night or early morning? I've been in Sunday at 8 a.m. before. And sometimes someone might be flying in, and then they're flying straight out, you know, and you need to do something, you know, fix an emergency. So that is something. And then I think there's something about being very impartial when it comes to confidentiality, and not being, caught up in kind of gossip or anything like that. Once you're with that person, they're a patient, and, you know, you still have to make sure that you're delivering on your very best work, not being caught up in
the celebrity
who the person is. And that can be difficult, but, you know, that's an important thing, is that, you know, you've always got to do your best work and think of them as a patient first.
A question for you, Richard, and don't want any names. Have there been some celebrities that have come to you and you think, actually, no, I just can't work with you after, like, the consultation?
Well, the funny thing is that, and I think a lot of people do say this, and it's sometimes the celebrities who just come into the limelight who could be more challenging or more difficult or more kind of taken away with the fame. So, you know, obviously there's lots of reality stars and majority, everyone is really great, but it can be that. Those reality stars, and some of them are extremely young and they're kind of cast into the spotlight, and you know the importance of everything that they're doing and on social media and the number of followers they have, and then they can kind of lose sight of how to treat other people, you know.
It's a bit like old money and new money, I would imagine, you know, that sort of like you know, old money you sort of perceive sometimes as just old money. We've always had money, so whereas new money can be a bit brash sometimes.
Yeah. You find the biggest stars are often the nicest people, and they're the most low-key.
This episode is brought to you with our charity partner, Wells on Wheels. Did you know that many girls in Indian villages miss out on education because they have to spend hours fetching water for their families? Wells on Wheels is changing that with the water wheel invention. A water wheel is a rollable drum that can carry 5 times as much water as a single bucket, making it easier for adults to collect more water in a single trip without risking injury and freeing up young girls from never having to collect water again. With the help of Wells on Wheels, over 2,000 girls are now attending school regularly. Join the cause and help the lives of ambitious girls today. For just £28, a water wheel can transform their futures immediately. Learn more and donate at wellsonwheels.co.uk. Now back to the episode.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Because they're just used to it.
Mm. And the very public profile of the patients that you've treated, the celebrities and the sports stars, does that have a trickle-down effect in terms of the lesser well-known patients who come to you? Are they of a similar demographic? Not at their level of profile or perhaps their level of earnings, but does it narrow the filter of who would typically come to you as a new patient?
Well, the interesting thing is that I really wanted and intended to treat all types of patients and people. So through that, with the celebrities, you know, I have such a vastly different type of people. We've got the cricketers like Kevin Peterson and Darren Bock and Stuart Broad, and then we've got Jamie Redknapp as a sports person, and then we've got, obviously, as you've said, music stars like Rita Ora. Yeah. And then we have the reality stars, and we've got Towie, The Only Way is Essex, and we've got Made in Chelsea, and we've got people from younger to older. And that's something I wanted for my practice. I didn't want it to feel like it was only one type of patient. And I also wanted it to feel like, you know, anybody who comes should be treated like a celebrity in a way. Like, you know, we want to treat everybody in the best way possible and give them that great experience and, you know, make them feel that special treatment and VIP treatment. You know, I'll always go out of my way as much as I can to do everything to make it the best, you know, treatment and experience possible.
And I suppose you've had to create, I'm assuming, quite a high entry point, so as it deters all the people who sort of like the wannabes who, I want to have my teeth done by you because you did Rita Ora, but the answer is I can't afford, I haven't got the disposable income. So you must have effectively had to create some sort of barrier to entry, really, or an entry point. That's quite an interesting one, because that's about valuing yourself, isn't it?
Yeah, obviously, you know, we're in a high street practice, so, you know, it comes at more high value treatments. We do have payment plans that people can split things into. And also we have other types. We have products as well and things. So people can kind of, you know, have a piece of that brand without necessarily coming to go into cleaning. So that's another thing. Or people could just come in for a simple cleaning, you know, and things. They don't always have to go through to the very top. Top treatments.
Were you always, obviously there's a very heavy cosmetic and restorative element to what you do, and there's kind of facial aesthetics as well. Was that something that has become, you know, more specialized and because of your patient base, or was that something that you were always interested before that happens to flow through to your patient base? You know, is it kind of, you know, the tail wagging the dog or the dog wagging the tail?
It's something I was always interested in, and I did do extra courses on aesthetics. That was my interest, so that's kind of why the practice took that direction, and obviously celebrities helped with that. And another thing that happened is I kind of like rode a wave of this cosmetic dentistry. I could never have seen how it really would evolve and become such a focus for people. I was just doing something that I was passionate about. And then behind me, there was this great growing, you know, interest in what I was doing. So, you know, being in the right place at the right time, that's another thing that kind of happened. And I think now they've always talked about British people and British teeth and things like that. Now people are more aware.
So the Americans always love talking about British teeth, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah, at some point they're going to have to stop about this, because actually I think our teeth are getting better.
They are. The truth is, they say, like, in America, obviously, like, firstly, there's people in Hollywood who, you know, some have great teeth. Some, you might say, their teeth are too much, you know. Yeah. So that's one thing. And then another thing is, like, in America is, even though it's an amazing country, it's a kind of mentality of sink or swim, and they have people with these amazing dental care and amazing smiles, and they have people who really don't have great dental care. So there is some level of myth there. They did a study and they did find that when you look at everything broadly, and especially, you know, those, the whole of America and all those people that you don't see who don't have the health insurance and dental insurance they need in America, they might not always have good teeth. And the British might have overall the middle ground better teeth.
There we go. We'll take that out. We'll take that little piece out and we'll use that. But I think you're right. I think when we talk about America, we're typically talking about the eastern and the western seaboards, aren't we? We're talking about kind of the New York side and then over from kind of Seattle down to California. There's a lot of people in the middle section. That get kind of captured in that.
That DSO guy that we spoke to, didn't he say something like 60% or something of dentists don't, people in America don't go to the dentist or something?
Yeah.
But then they criticise the English teeth. That's all that about.
and you've got another side to your business as well, haven't you? Because you very recently sold Diamond Whites, the whitening product and the liner business, to Impress, the orthodontic clinic. And you've joined them as clinical director. So congratulations on that, which is amazing. What was the driver to create Diamond Whites back in 2012? And what was that journey like through to kind of exiting and partnering with Impress?
So it's an interesting story. I have a business partner, Ben Reed, who came from a finance background. And he also came from a regulatory background as well. So he was really good on those sides of things. And obviously, my part was the clinical aspect. And we wanted to bring aligners. Aligners and orthodontics really had a very high price point. And this was the chance for us to bring that to a wider market. We talked about kind of like bringing the brand out to a wider market. So it was about creating like a more affordable aligners. And we were also using remote monitoring, which is an AI. So it's like using things that are very much like on the forefront of technology so that people need less visits. So, you know, it combines digital dentistry, 3D printing, imaging, and this AI. These systems can kind of pick up whether the aligner is seated properly and also whether the gums are inflamed, and it kind of just flags it. So the dentist still needs to double check that. But it just flags it, and it can tell whether the patient should be wearing their aligner for a little bit longer, and then you can have less frequency of visits in between. So we kind of started that off, and we used partner clinics, one of them being my clinic, and it really kind of grew rapidly. Again, we had a celebrity following, and after that, as it was growing, we thought, look, we want to take this to the next stage, but we recognized that we needed a partner in that, and that's when we were kind of introduced to Impress, and they're a much larger company with clinics, and they're global, and they were just entering UK, and they were looking for a partner in UK that kind of understood the UK market. So everything came at a perfect time, and it allowed us, they have clinics kind of all over UK, so it allowed us to have a better reach of clinics, and they also are able to do more complex orthodontics. So it's a broader range of offering as well. But they also wanted me on board in order to kind of help to expand the cosmetic and restorative dentistry side offered within their business. So it really worked really well with the synergy, and with Ben, the way that he had, we had kind of built a lot of our own software systems and those things, and how we had kind of built a really good team, and customer service had been something that was really important to us. So, all of those things we bring on board as well. And it's an amazing partnership. We're really happy, and we think we can do even more amazing things than we've already done. Awesome.
And it makes sense as well, because that space that you're in, there's some very big players. There's some global players in that space. So to bring in a larger partner to help you get to the next level makes sense. Because like you say, I think the adoption of AI in that space is becoming more and more common. The very big dominant player who we all know, they're not backing off. So to have somebody that can help you move forward makes good sense. And it's nice that you're going to be able to bring your restorative and cosmetic element to their services as well, which is an area you're very strong in.
Yeah, I believe, there's room for everybody in the market, and, orthodontics and these clear aligners, this is a growing trend, not only within UK, but globally, and also more people are having it done at different ages. Aligners for teenagers now, and even obviously people who more mature people as well. So it's that market is growing anyway. So we feel like, in my opinion, there's room for everybody in the market. But there is, at the same time, there's a consolidation. So there were lots of challenger brands, and now we feel like the market's consolidated, and we just want to provide the best service we can.
Brilliant. Just going back to your practice, Richard, what would you say have been the highs and lows of kind of building and running your dental practice? Because the danger is people leave this thinking, wow, he's a rock star, it's all celebrities, it's all fireworks and parties and champagne, it all looks so easy. We need to lift the drain covers. There's got to be some hard yards that went on in there as well.
Yeah, well, there are many difficult parts. And I think when I first started the business, I had just come out of I was doing very well in mixed practice, and I'd been doing locuming, so I was doing very well. And then I had to kind of go back to square one. And when I first opened, all of a sudden I had rent to pay, staff to pay, materials to pay, and next to no patients, one patient a day. And I remember, and I always tell this to people, I remember not being, not going to Starbucks or Pret, which is a very common thing to do in London, because that £3 was too much, I had to pay my staff. And the funny thing was, my staff were going.
That's so often the way, though, isn't it?
I remember thinking at this point when I'm right starting in terms of disposable income, because everything has to go back in the business, my dental nurses and receptionists have far more disposable income than I do, you know, and this is something that I had to go through in order to, you know, get to the, to where we did manage to get. And I think it also, like, valuing the team is really important. You know, I've always been a big believer in that, you know, taking them out on meals and, you know, pay rises. My staff are not striking. Not yet, anyway. And other things, other challenges that you face are to do with difficult patient cases. There's some cases which really can just stay on your mind, and you're trying to achieve something and it doesn't go the way you want, and you know, it can be really heartbreaking. You know, I started I was placing implants, which I don't do now, but some of them wouldn't take, they wouldn't integrate. That was just so heartbreaking, because you've done everything you can, and you know, you don't want to blame anybody, but you know, you just feel really let down by it. And and I think other things is when someone has an emergency, that's a big stress, you know. You get an email or a call, I'm in pain, when can I come in, you know, you'll be on holiday. That's a really nice thing about having a team now. Where luckily where I'm situated in London, there's lots of practices you could refer to. So even when I was practicing on my own, there were practices I could refer to, and now I have a team. But that's another thing, when you first start, it can be quite lonely. You know, people say that, like, you're responsible for Exactly. You're responsible for paying the staff. You're responsible for their well-being. You're responsible for your patients. You're responsible for providing the best dentistry. You're responsible for being there, being present, and giving your best whatever you're going through. You know, I went through a huge breakup and I still had to turn up to work, you know. So I think there's so many challenges, but you learn, and challenges is what makes you, you know, it makes you or breaks you. Hope it makes you. Or more to find is that each thing is a learning experience, you know. It's okay to go through struggles, and that's okay. That is okay. And you know, it that's what teaches you. You know, all of these things teach you. So I think it's not to be afraid of that, you know, those difficult things. Let's say that, not be afraid of failure, not be afraid of making mistakes. You know, those are,
but I think that's your point you make about loneliness as well. We hear that quite a lot by principals in that. It's hard to know, because you don't necessarily want to take it back to your partner, because you don't want to always be talking about work.
Also, they might not be very interested.
No, brilliant. And I think, you know, it's not a very British thing to kind of talk about problems to the extent that perhaps we should. And I think within a clinical environment, sometimes you need to be very careful and cautious about who you would share some of your failures with, because again, I don't think we have kind of the culture. So for example, Black Box Thinking, the book by Matthew Syed, where in the air industry, they share failure so that everybody in the industry learns together. That doesn't happen in medicine and within dentistry. So people are quite cautious about who they talk to about things. And I think that kind of brings about a degree of loneliness. So when you end up with a team, I think it does get easier because you're kind of in that environment together.
Well, imagine, you know, you did 50 different restorations. One of them is going to need root canal. It's not your fault. Do you know what I mean? And so, and that's really heartbreaking and difficult, because the patient's in pain. Some patients say, I was better before I started. Where everything was fine before you got involved.
It's your fault. It's your fault.
Exactly. But I think that, you know, these things are medical procedures, and obviously those things can happen, and we always warn if it's a deep filling, it shows, it's mainly x-rays. You know, you get better at that as you go along, you know, and And someone always said to me, explain everything before you start, because it's an explanation before, but after it's an excuse, you know?
Yeah, that's a good true.
Point.
That's, very
that's
good
a really
point,
good
yeah.
point. If you had to distill down all of your learnings through your entrepreneurial journey into one single thing, what would be the one thing you'd want to take with you that you learned through the process?
I think the important thing is to be true and authentic to yourself. So do something that is authentically what you believe in. Stay true to your belief as much as you can. And that comes with everything, the work you do, and also how you manage your team. And you know, you can always take certain shortcuts. But if you can just stay true to yourself, then that's a much more fulfilling journey. It might be harder, but in the long run, it's more fulfilling.
That's great. I think it's really good. Mm. You said something at the beginning, Richard, about you might have been a writer. You actually are, aren't you? Because in our prep, we were talking, and you've actually got a book, a fiction book, published on Amazon. So what was that? So what genre was it? What was the book that you wrote?
Well, it's quite interesting. My mother has always been really good in terms of English and English literature. One of my sisters actually did an English literature degree and master's. So there's something yeah. there. And it was some other passion of mine. My A-levels were actually biology, chemistry, and English literature.
Oh.
So rather than, because at that time you could choose one other
right.
random subject or wild card, right. you know, which actually really helped because it's about communication yeah. and writing and expressing yourself, which I think is really important. Mm. And so I had a passion for it, the English language. I loved, you know, all of those things. But this book was actually a fiction book, and it was it's on Amazon. It's called Amanda, after that's my sister's name. And what it is kind of like a Bond style novel, mm. but turned on its head, with the female being the protagonist of this story, which I thought was really interesting because I'm a big Bond fan. But I always did think in those Bonds, because it's of the time, you know, you can take it for what it is. But women were put in a very particular position, and then obviously Bond is in a certain way. So,
the Bond girl is a known phrase, yeah. isn't it?
Yeah. So I wanted to really turn that on its head for this novel, and that was quite fun. And the difficulty, in some ways, was like having a strong female character that still people could identify with, and you know, that still had a softness and femininity to them, and so that, you know, it's quite a challenging thing, but also it's quite a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, because obviously since Daniel Craig's gone, and we don't know who the next 007 is going to be, but there was lots of talk about whether there's a possibility of being a female Bond. So it's interesting that you wrote this story, and there's talk about it.
Can't be a female Bond.
The thing is, you know, everyone's got a different idea of it, but you know, I am a massive fan of James Bond anyway. I think it's so cool, and it's really quintessentially English. And you know, everyone's favorite is Sean Connery, obviously, but I also
agree on that.
I like ones like Roger Moore, who's kind of half ridiculous and fun, it was just poppish. Like,
yeah.
And I also like Daniel Craig, who's much more powerful and you know, rugged.
Blimey, you're covering all your bases, aren't you?
Did you do any of your teeth though, Richard? that's the question.
Do you want to mention Pierce Brosnan in there somewhere?
or the one that George Lazenby.
George Lazenby.
The one show for George Lazenby.
Yeah, okay. Casino Royale.
Sean Connery is still the best.
he is. Richard, it's been wonderful talking to you. We always finish up in the same way. We like to ask our guests the same two questions. And the first one we have for you is, if you could be the fly on a wall in a situation, where would you like to take yourself to?
It's a really interesting question. And obviously this would be something perhaps a past situation. One of the moments that I'm really interested in film, old film and things like that. So I think that moment where Marilyn Monroe was singing Happy Birthday to JFK, yes, and the awkwardness of that moment.
Yeah.
But as a fly on the wall, you'd be fine because you can fly off.
Yeah, when it gets too awkward, you can leave. Oops.
But I think that's a real moment in history. And, you know, it's an amazing moment. And, you know, there's lots of interest in Marilyn at this time, the documentary. And it's just these characters were so larger than life. Yeah. And
it's amazing, you know, the interest still in her, isn't it?
Well, it's a fairly recent film, isn't there, that's not been out so long about her. Yeah,
it's phenomenal that she's got such an impact on the world still.
And I suppose because of the connection to the Kennedys and everything else and the circumstances in which she died.
I also love Jackie Kennedy, so I can see the, you know, the dichotomy and pain in that part.
Yeah. Yeah, no, wonderful, wonderful. And the last one is, if you could meet somebody, if you could have the opportunity to sit down and have a coffee or a glass of wine with somebody, who would you like to meet?
So this is a current figure I'm thinking of. Somebody who I really think is amazing is Obama. I know it's a kind of random or interesting one, but I just think it was so groundbreaking, and he was such, he was and is such an amazing speaker, really inspirational. He got the whole crowd on his side, and he manages to be both really kind of authoritative and demanding of respect, and at the same time, he's kind of be humble and with the people and down with it. Do you know what I mean? I have a huge respect. You know, a lot of people said his political time was very difficult because, you know, he couldn't necessarily do all of the things that he wanted to do. But my feeling is the intention were there, you know. He wanted to give healthcare to people. I mean, that to me shows enough, you know.
Yeah, I read his autobiography, or the half that's out. And I think he deeply cares about the things that matter to him and people. But you're spot on as a speaker. You can just YouTube him and listen to him for hours because he's amazing, absolutely amazing.
And he's got a good sense of humour.
He does.
Exactly, which is always important.
Richard, thank you for your time. We know that you're an incredibly busy guy, so we really appreciate you breaking away from your patience to see us. Thank you very much. Keep well, and hopefully we'll be catching up very soon.
So we'll see you around.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dentology, where we discuss the business of dentistry. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe where you found this episode. That would be amazing. And also follow us on Instagram.